Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
I reserve missing just for me. Everybody knows I want them.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Bonnie Montgomery? Do y'all like Bonnie? Arkansas, born and bred, Bonnie Montgomery is a classically trained composer and opera singer by day and country queen by night. She has been featured on CNN and in The New Yorker, The Maddow Blog, and The Huffington Post, just to name a few. More can be heard at BonnieMontgomeryMusic.com. All right, well, welcome to a very special Tales from the South on the Road, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at First United Methodist Church in Benton, Arkansas, with a live audience of over 160 people. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each show we feature an artist and we take our set on the road with us and do the same. So tonight our featured artist is Little Rock painter Doug Norton. And our featured piece, these are all Doug's pieces, but our featured piece is this one here entitled Rooster, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Doug at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight's storytellers are all from the Benton area, and their stories center around how sometimes things are not what they seem. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Freddie Burton is part of a secret plan to outrun everyone else. And we'll end the night with Sam Stewart as two things occur simultaneously and the confusion begins. But let's start the night with Alma Joyce Hahn on her front porch as she thinks she knows how to handle an enemy in Lessons from a Postage Stamp.
One hot summer afternoon in 1941, when I was barely 7 years old, I was sitting on the front porch of our military housing unit reading a Nancy Drew mystery. School was out for the summer and I was bored. Suddenly a truck turned into the street and stopped in front of our quarters. Two military policemen, we called them MPs, climbed out of the cab and four from the open back, their bayonet tips, guns drawn. After determining all was safe, they allowed blue-clad POWs to hop out and begin their work. My first thought was to run into the house and lock the door, but I was fascinated to be so close to the devil incarnate. I felt very brave to be in the presence of such evil. Just a few months earlier, the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. I did not even know what the word war meant. I would have also been at a loss to explain exactly what hate was, either, even though at least once a week I stood on my front porch, hands on my hips, yelling, "I hate you, Jimmy Tones!" At school the next day, everyone was talking about what had happened at Pearl Harbor. All my classmates were children of military personnel, and we attended class in a remodeled old barracks left over from the time Fort Sill's main purpose had been to protect the settlers from the Apache tribes who made their homes in the Ouachita Mountains nearby. During recess, we talked much about what had happened. Everyone avowed the Japanese and the German people were the most hated people in the whole world. I hadn't a clue what a German or a Japanese person looked like, nor did I know anything about them. But soon I too was proclaiming my hatred of them. The following weeks brought many changes. My father was assigned to new bases frequently. I grew used to hearing air raid sirens, stumbling around during blackouts, looking skyward as searchlights crisscrossed the sky. Then came the day when the truck pulled up. The air base where my father was assigned housed a large prisoner of war detention facility, and our housing units were close by. The POWs needed to be kept busy, and so it was not uncommon for groups of them to be working in our housing development. They did repairs on our houses, fixed the plumbing, mowed the yards, trimmed the shrubbery, and as our quarters were built in an old orange grove, they picked the oranges. But I had only ever seen them from a distance, never close up. The men were dressed in government-issue work clothes. The letters POW were stenciled in 4-inch tall letters across the back of their work shirts. I stared at them intently, proud of my intestinal fortitude in the presence of such vile people. They ignored me, but went quietly about their assigned tasks. After a time, one of them looked up and noticed my interest. He was young. He didn't look any older than Larry, who lived across the street and was in high school. When the prisoner noticed I was watching him, he smiled at me. That scared me a bit, but I did not acknowledge his friendship. I just continued to stare coldly back at him. Soon his attention was on his work. I had unconsciously picked up a small pebble and was tossing it idly in my hand. Without knowing why, I threw the pebble as hard as I could at the POW, hitting him squarely on the side of the head just above the ear. Kapowie! Boy, I'll bet that stung. One of the guards saw his reaction and went over to him. The POW told the guard with a sort of sign language what had happened and pointed in my direction. I stared back at them. The guard took the stone, flipped it in the air, and caught it as he rang our doorbell. Following a short conversation with my mother, he returned to the truck. My mother called me into the house. Now! After my backside was warmed, I was sent to my room with the words, "Just wait till your father gets home." The next day, I was once again sitting outside under the orange tree, reading when the trucks came back and unloaded their cargo of prisoners who were again working in the neighborhood. I did not look up, but I noted that the young prisoner I had hit with a rock was back again. Without looking up, I noticed he had called the guard over to his side. "I bet he's going to say I did something else," I thought. The young POW reached into his shirt pocket. As I watched, he pulled a small piece of paper from his pocket and gave it to the guard, again pointing in my direction. I wanted to run into the house, but I didn't. Taking the scrap of paper, the guard walked up to where I sat. His shadow fell across me as I raised my eyes to look at him. "He said to give you this," the guard said, handing me a bit of paper. I was scared, but I snatched it up and I ran in the house without looking at it. When I got to my room, I slammed the door. I opened my hand to see what the POW had given me. I half expected it to be a snake, but no, it was a small corner torn from an envelope. On it was affixed a colorful postage stamp. There were German words on it and the black cancellation marks across it. I thought it was pretty. Without knowing why, I put the paper into a small cedar jewelry box. And I wondered, as I looked at the slip of paper through the years, just what was on that envelope? Who sent him the envelope he had torn the stamp from? Was it his sister? Perhaps my age? Or was it his mother who missed her only son in a far-off land? Perhaps it was from a sweetheart whose boyfriend was in a prison camp in Florida. The stamp stayed in the cedar chest through the years. I never looked at it except occasionally. I never told anyone or showed it to anyone. But through the years, I've wondered what happened to the young man. Is he perhaps alive today? And does he tell a grandchild of his about the little girl who hit him with a rock?
Alma Joyce Hahn is a retired teacher who has lived much of her life in Benton, Arkansas. She writes a weekly general interest column for the local newspaper, the Benton Courier, and is a watercolor artist. Next, Freddie Burton schemes with his father to trick their opponents in a race he'll never forget in Dodge Day.
When my father told me about the secret plan to bring a car to town from Dallas, Texas, I was told not to say one word. This car was a 1963 two-door white Biscayne with a 427 cubic inch block bored out to a 430 horsepower. On top of this, it was driven by the famous Ronnie Socks, whose nickname was Mr. Four-Speed. It was going to be a total surprise for Sunday's Dodge Day at the Little Rock Drag Strip on I-30. This was the plan. The friendly Chevrolet car was to be brought to town around midnight to Spivey Chevrolet. My father had arranged to meet Ronnie Socks at a certain time at the garage. My father had promised to wake me up and take me with him to open the garage so he could hide the car until Sunday afternoon. It was so hard to keep my mouth shut and equally as hard to shut my eyes, anticipating the arrival of an awesome car and Mr. Four-Speed. It was 1963, and I was soon to be 16. Like most boys my age, I was car crazy. The first book I read in Miss Petty's library was Boy Gets Car, and probably the last book I read, by Henry G. Henson. To make it worse, the pop music of the day was fueling that fire and desire to drive fast, hot cars. There were so many that space prohibits the naming of all the songs, but I can't help but list a few by musical artists like James and Dean and the Beach Boys. Little Deuce Coupe, Shutdown, 409, Rocket 88, GTO, The Little Old Lady from Pasadena, and then the last but not least is Drag City. I think that's enough. At that time, my father, Jax Burton, was the sales manager of Spivey Chevrolet in Benton, Arkansas. Chevrolet and most all GM cars were the favorite of the local drag racing crowd. GM's short-stroke engine made them excel in the quarter-mile race. There was a club also called the Strokers in Benton. To become a member, you had to beat one of the original members in the quarter-mile unofficial drag strips in our area. The most popular was Highway 35 going out of town towards Sheridan. All these guys loved fast cars and pretty girls. These are just a few of the members of the clubs, or the members that drove the cars. Glenn Suggs had a beautiful 1963 Chevrolet Impala Supersport with 327, 300 horse. Punk Sanders had a 1962 beautiful black Chevy Impala with a 409. Randy Barker had a Pontiac Bonneville with a 421. Awesome car. And then Max Stiles had the prettiest convertible, 1961 Chevrolet Impala with a 327. I knew my father would never let me have one of these cars. He could see the fire in my eyes when I talked about drag racing. When I did get a driving age, he let me drive a 1964 Chevrolet Supersport, 327 cubic inch, 240 horse with a two-barrel carburetor. And added on top of that, it had automatic Power Glide transmission. It was beautiful, Laguna blue with white bucket seats, white top, looked like I could go fast, but it was real pretty, but not fast enough to hang in with the big boys. I did manage to burn the rubber off the right rear tire, but every few months somehow. When my father would jump on me, my mother would always come to my defense and say, "Jax, you know that original equipment tires on cars today are cheap. Ralph Nader says they're not worth but $3 a piece." My mother was very naive. He knew better, but just didn't want to fuss with her. It was a hot July summer in 1963, and Thomas Otto, the local Chrysler dealer in Benton, Arkansas, was sponsored a Sunday drag race at the Little Rock Drag Strip. This was their attempt to break into the local market of these young race drivers. I might add, Thomas was directly across the street from Spivey Chevrolet. This made for an aggressive, friendly competition when your customers could get a prize from you and then walk across the street to your competitor. Even though Chevrolet had the advantage, the Thomas boys were very aggressive and would do whatever it took to get someone out of Chevrolet. The Benton Courier in 1963 wrote, "Benton's Thomas Dodge Plymouth Chrysler dealer will sponsor, quote, drag day at the Little Rock Drag Strip on I-30 on Sunday afternoon, featuring some of the hottest Dodges on the road. According to Raymond and Clyde Thomas, some of the best Dodge stock cars in the Southwest will be on hand to compete against all challengers." Needless to say, this made the owner of Spivey Chevrolet, Varin Spivey, see red. He knew of no local car that could take on this challenge. This meant lost sales to Thomas Otto just across the street. Freddie Newcomb was a salesman at Spivey Chevrolet and himself a racing enthusiast, told Mr. Spivey of a car sponsored by Friendly Chevrolet out of Dallas, Texas. Mr. Spivey paid whatever it took and hired Mr. Four-Speed. I'll never forget seeing that monster of a car at midnight as it pulled into the garage to be hidden until the race. It was high up on a trailer being towed by a Chevy pickup. I almost fainted from excitement when I saw this white Chevrolet with black letters on the front fender, 427 cubic inches, 430 horsepower, racing flags of black and white and red, and these huge slicks on the back. Surely this 16-year-old boy's dream had come true. The only thing that could get my heart racing that fast was seeing Veronica Dopparilla at the Tyndall Park swimming pool. It was hard to sleep that night. Sunday, my father and I drove in a car leading the Friendly Chevrolet into the pit area of the Little Rock Drag Strip. The Dodge race team was already there. The spectators were all around the drivers in their cars. The team drivers were wearing their professional white jumpsuits with patches which read Dodge, Plymouth Chrysler, Hemi. Their race cars were lettered from fender to fender. It was quite a sight until the Dodge race team members noticed and spotted Friendly Chevrolet being towed into the pit area. I'll never forget the faces of the Dodge race drivers. Just moments before, they were the celebrities. They knew well the reputation of the car being towed into the pit area. To make a long story short, I'll just quote the half-page ad Spivey Chevrolet put in the Benton Courier the week after the Big Sunday Challenge. Quote, "Chevrolet accepts Dodge Challenge successfully. Chevrolet outperforms the best hand-picked Dodges in the Southwest. At the Little Rock Drag Strip last Sunday, a 1963 Chevrolet, sponsored by Spivey Chevrolet, accepted the best Dodge had to offer and won every race. The judges' decision in these five races has never been questioned. The judges are as followed, the buying public."
Born in 1947 to the late Robert Jax and Elsie Burton, Robert Freddie Burton graduated from Benton High School in 1965, worked for his father at Crane and Burton Ford until 1974, and then he and his father started Burton Ford, which Freddie operated until 1986. In 1992, he was elected Saline County Clerk and retired in 2012. He and his wife Brenda have been married since 1966. In our final story of the night, Sam Stewart is minding the family's store, watching for shoplifters, when the door opens and things start happening in Add a Snicker.
All
I'll never forget that hot day in July 1956. I was 9 years old and sitting at the counter in my parents' mom and pop grocery in Benton, Arkansas. Dad had just walked outside to get in his truck. In those days, ladies stayed home while men drove the one and only car or truck to work. So the ladies would phone in their orders, mom would take them down, and then dad would fill the order, hop in his green 1949 Ford, and deliver them. Sometimes I'd ride along, sometimes I'd stay at the store with mom. Dad worried about my mother staying in the store alone when he was gone. But mom, who was raised on a farm, had a 45 under the counter and she could shoot better than dad could. July in Arkansas can be plain awful, humid and hot beyond anything a person should have to endure. The store had 6 big black ceiling fans, and they put out a persistent hum that combined with the heat could almost put you to sleep when business was slow. The main door was kept open, but there was a screen door with large orange letters, Colonial Bread, blazed across the screen. As a person came into the store, the first thing they saw was a counter running right in front of the door. The counter displayed all the snack goodies, candy bars, gum, jerky, crackers, and the red Coke box with Coca-Cola scripted on the front and full of Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Grape-It, Clem Orange, and Knee-High, all for 5 cents. That sat at the end of the counter. You could hear the icy water circulating among the soda pops, Temptation right there in front of a hot, thirsty human. And if the customer got a cold drink, a Snicker bar seemed to be the accompaniment of choice for most folks. Even though it was safe to walk down the street, day or night, our house doors were seldom locked, and in the summer, windows were left wide open, hoping to catch a breeze, yet shoplifters were always a problem for a grocer. Robbery was always a fear. Unlike today, most people paid in cash, and they paid their weekly or monthly bills in cash too. Some days, Dad would take in $1,000 in cash, and at closing time, run it down to Benton State Bank's night deposit. $1,000 in the 50s would be like 5, 6, or even 10 times that today. That hot July day, my favorite customer came into the store. Ms. Chastain was a full-figured lady in her 80s. I guess because she had grown up in the 1800s, she wore black dresses nearly down to the floor and always carried a big umbrella, rain or shine. Miss Chastain was fair-complexioned and probably never had a suntan in her life. She had a bun of shiny gray hair. Pentecostal was Dad's guess. She was, as I think back, the perfect Southern lady, and you could always predict Miss Chastain's order. She loved her Cokes. One a day was an absolute must, and Dad's fresh meat was always on her list, along with Calumet and 20 Mulatine Borax. She must have had the cleanest laundry in Benton because she was always getting soap. It just so happened that 2 significant things happened almost simultaneously as Miss Chastain came through the screen door. Dad left on a delivery, and a big, dirty black truck pulled in the parking area in front of the store, and 3 large men piled out. The men's car carried a Texas license plate on the front, and so I parked my 9-year-old self in the assigned spot near the front counter to watch for shoplifting of the snacks. I was to have a sneezing fit if I saw anything, and Mom and Dad would take it from there. Now, it just so happened that as Dad left, he glanced back to see both Ms. Chastain's entry and the men getting out of the car. Dad said later that he had a funny feeling, would have turned around and come back, but he was carrying milk and ice cream for Mrs. Morgan over on 4th Street, and with the heat, he was afraid to waste time. So off drove Dad. When Dad returned to the store, he saw the 3 men run from the store, get into their car, and drive off, pea gravel flying. He also encountered Ms. Chastain coming through the front door. She was yelling, "Robbery, robbery," and clutching a severely bent umbrella. The panic was obvious on Dad's face as he rushed in the door and yelled for my mother. It took some explaining to calm Dad down. Ms. Chastain had gotten to the checkout stand just as the 3 Texans approached it. She was carrying her usual carton of 6 Cokes. Mom rang up the price, 30 cents. "What?" Miss Chastain said. "Miss Stewart, you made a mistake. The carton of Cokes is only 25. "No," Mom said. "They've raised the price to 6 cents a Coke, or a carton of six for 30. Miss Chastain flew into a frenzy. "They've always been 5 cents a Coke with a carton 25. Been that way since I was a kid." I'd never seen Miss Chastain like this. She was a Southern lady, so polite, so soft-spoken, sometimes almost whispering. Her eyes bulged and she repeated, "They are 5 cents, always have been that way." And over again she said it. Each time she got louder than the first. "I won't pay it, I won't pay it. That's 20% increase." "Why, it's robbery," she said, "robbery, robbery." And at that, one of the Texans said, "Lady, this is the 1950s, not the 1890s. Oh gosh, he regretted opening his mouth. Miss Chastain swung around with a speed that would befit a 20-year-old. Umbrella in hand, she swiped the air, and the current was more than the ceiling fans put out. The umbrella came down to the man's immediate left and hit the rack of jerky. Jerky went flying. You get back to Texas," she shouted. And wow, the men tore out the door and I guess headed for Texas. But Miss Chastain was right behind them with her umbrella yelling, "Robbery, robbery, it's robbery." She left, and it was almost 2 weeks before Miss Chastain came back to Stewart's. She bought her Cokes all right, and she paid the 30 cents grudgingly. And as she paid, she was mumbling something. Dad was checking her out and could hear her plain as day. He said later that he reckoned she wasn't Pentecostal after all. That was more excitement than most 9-year-olds have in a lifetime. The only thing that would calm my young nerves was an ice-cold gray pet and add a snicker.
Sam Stewart is a retired teacher, principal, and assistant superintendent in the Little Rock School District. 4 times Electric Central High's favorite teacher. In 1998, he was Teacher of the Year in Little Rock. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here on the road in Benton, Arkansas. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. Tales on the Road is made possible through a grant by the Arkansas Arts Council's Arts on Tour program and the National Endowment for the Arts. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week back at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.